Welcome to Access Advocacy on thepowerofvoices.com. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. The goals of Access Advocacy are to improve the lives of patients and caregivers who are dealing with the chronic illness of sickle cell disease. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Thomas D. Coates of Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. He is a staple of our community and the place where many of us found hope and help at Children's Hospital. So, Dr. Coates, tell us a little bit about your history in the community.
Well, I'm a pediatric hematologist, although I have children now in their 60s and 70s that I see in clinics, so I guess that redefines what pediatrics is. I specialize in blood diseases and cancer in children, but I haven't really done any cancer work for about 20 years. My main interest has been in non-malignant blood diseases with a big focus on sickle cell disease and thalassemia. So I'm within the Children's Center for Cancer, Blood Diseases, and Bone Marrow Transplantation here at Children's. I'm the section head of the non-malignant hematology part of that group. I'm also a professor of pediatrics and pathology at the University of Southern California. So we've been involved and interested in both research related to sickle cell disease and also clinical management of patients with sickle cell disease for a number of years.
That's right. I think that's one of the things that makes the work that you're doing so interesting to us is the fact that you are practicing as well as being a formal researcher, and puts you in the unique opportunity of actually helping families understand the importance of us participating in research. As a matter of fact, I have three people that I advocate for who were actually participants in some of your earlier research programs, and they speak very highly of that experience and have worked as advocates in getting other people to sign up for research. So just a little plug for you and your research.
No, that's terrific. We can't really do anything without the help of the patients, and our patients have really been fantastic. It's amazing to me. They drive sometimes for hours to get here to participate in these programs, and we have a big focus in trying to understand pain and understand the physiology of sickle cell disease so that we can treat the patients better. And there's a lot of interest in mouse research. As you may know, we can give sickle cell disease to mice, but what you find in mice and what we find in humans is really quite different, and so I think that our focus has been on trying to do these studies in people, and hopefully we can help them a lot better. One of the things that's been amazing to me that we found in our recent work is really we've found the scientific basis for what patients and what mothers have been saying to us for decades, or saying to me for decades. I find that a little bit amusing. Maybe we could have saved a lot of money if we just listened to them in the first place.
Well, as a mom, I think you're right. And I am so happy that that science is backing us up. You know, we were so long being told that, you know, you're just a mom, and, you know, I have to say, I've never heard you say that you're just a mom, but I've been told that by many other people. So one of the really interesting things to me about your latest work was the whole concept of pain. I had, for many years, been one of those moms saying, well, my child is in pain, but this is different, or working with her, trying to get her to describe her pain, and noticing that sometimes she would say things like, oh, it's like a tingling. It starts like a tingling pain, like I sat on my hands too long, or she'd describe it as a burning pain, or sometimes there would be a sharp pain. But I have to say that you were the first doctor I ever heard really speak to the different types of pain that a person living with sickle cell disease can have. Can you, for our listeners, give a brief description of the various types of pain that has been documented and researched by yourself?
Well, I think that this is a really important point, and there's a lot of misunderstanding about this amongst physicians to start with, and certainly amongst patients. It's very important to understand this and to teach patients and doctors to recognize these different kinds of pain. I mean, pain is a mechanism that was designed to tell us when there's damage occurring to our bodies. And in sickle cell disease, you know, the red cells become very rigid when normally the job of the red cell is to carry oxygen from our lungs to our body. And this red protein called hemoglobin that's in the red cells does this. And normal hemoglobin picks up oxygen in the lung and releases it in our tissue. And the red cells remain very flexible. When you look at them under the microscope, they're like little bags of water. They can bend and fold and slide through the blood vessels without any difficulty. In sickle cell disease, when the red cell loses its oxygen in the tissue, that liquid transforms into a solid, and the red cells become very stiff and they get stuck, and that blocks the blood flow to that area, and that's what we think causes the pain in sickle cell. So it's like putting a tourniquet on your arm. You cut off the blood supply. So that causes damage to the tissue, and the nerves there sense that, and they send a signal to our brain to say, you know, there's something going on in your leg right now, for example. And so this is the normal reason that we have pain receptors there. You put your hand on something hot, you detect that there's pain, you pull your hand away. And the medical term for this is nociceptive pain. And nociceptive just means, it detects or it receives a noxious signal. So that's the kind of pain that you have when you break your arm or stub your toe. And that kind of pain actually is quite sensitive to pain medications, especially narcotic pain medications. So if you break your wrist and I give you some morphine, the pain will go away within, 10 minutes of the time I give you the medicine. If nerves are exposed to constant pain all the time, they will start generating pain pulses even when the damage signal is taken away. And this causes this second kind of pain, which I'll refer to as neuropathic pain. And this is really, really difficult to deal with. And it doesn't have to just be from sickle cell disease. It can be from anything. I mean, people that have a severe fracture of their leg or something like that, and they have a lot of pain from the damage, can have this constant bombardment of their nervous system by these pain signals, and their nerves will start to send pain pulses even after your back is healed or your leg is healed. So this is neuropathic pain, also sometimes called pain amplification syndromes, because it's very much, the pain signal goes from your leg to your spinal cord and then back up to your brain, and in your spinal cord there's a switching mechanism that sends the signals different places. And when this happens, it's very much like turning the amplifier up on your stereo, You turn it up and you hear a little bit of hissing, but if you touch the needle of your record player, you hear a huge blast of sound, whereas if you turn the amplifier way down, you don't get that big blast of sound. So if your spinal cord is constantly being bombarded with pain, it's like turning the volume up. So a very tiny stimulus can cause a huge response. And this kind of pain occurs secondary to the initial insult, which was, for example, your sickle crisis that was going on for a long time. And what's characteristic of this kind of pain is it does not respond to narcotics. And in fact, narcotics make it worse. And so, you've heard a lot in the local press about the terrible problem we have with a narcotic addiction from prescription medications. Well, a lot of that is related to this problem. Patients start out having pain. They get narcotics because their tooth hurt or their leg was broken. And then the pain gets worse and worse and worse, and they keep going up and up on their narcotics because they want to make the pain go away. But in fact, what's happened is they've developed this second kind of pain, this nerve pain. And the nerve pain doesn't get better with narcotics, and it's made worse by narcotics, and so they keep getting worse and worse and worse, and they wind up on higher and higher doses of narcotic pain medications. This happens to patients with sickle cell disease as well. So So the patients think they have pain and they want more narcotics, not because they're addicts or because they're bad people or something, but because they have more pain. And so the very thing they think that's helping them is in fact making them worse. So there's a huge issue with this, and I think that physicians don't understand this either. And they don't understand when the patients come into the emergency room what's going on. They can be very prejudicial. And one of the things that we understand about this neuropathic pain, or any kind of pain as a matter of fact, is that anxiety and fear make it much worse. That's one of the things that we're studying in the laboratory now. We did some very interesting experiments where we induced pain in kids, and we actually have a fancy machine, and many of the patients, it hurts what we do to them. So we are hurting them, and they are putting up with that because they want to help. Okay, this is really terrific. And so when we first started doing this, we had this machine that causes pain, and then we measure the responses of the blood flow. And my laboratory people came in and they said, Dr. Coates, look at this. We have all this on a computer screen, so we know exactly when the pain is happening. And the patients had these huge responses 2 minutes before they had the pain. Before they had the pain.
Wow.
And so, and you can see this on the computer screen. In fact, we're going to be presenting some of this stuff. We're setting up a program here at Children's where we're going to invite the patients and sickle patients to come, and we're going to show them all this data. But so I said to the lab folks, they can't read your mind. I mean, what's going on? And I asked the lab folks what's happening. Well, 2 minutes before the pain pulse came, the lab person said to the patient, you're going to feel pain in a couple of minutes.
Oh.
And we saw this huge response to their blood flow, to those words. And so this whole pain thing is really complicated. You have physiologic responses. You know, I mean, for years, the mother, moms would say, oh, my daughter's boyfriend left her, and she had a sickle crisis several hours later. And, I'd roll my eyes and think, okay, this is crazy. I don't believe it. I believe that now. Stress and emotional stress like this causes these big physiologic responses that amplify the pain response. And so, again, I come back to what I've been told by my patients and my mothers for years. We can now see this on the computer when we look at it. And so this second neuropathic stuff, this second kind of pain, is really modulated tremendously by anxiety and by attitude and fear. You go to an emergency room and you're expecting that you're going to get, bad interaction with the staff. You're going to be accused of being a drug addict. All of that makes all these responses worse. And then people wonder why they don't get better when they go to the emergency room. And on top of that, the patients are looking for a pill to fix that stuff, and there isn't one. So the nerve pain is a separate entity. The patients, we really need to work with them to learn about that. And we need to work with doctors to learn to recognize that and what can we do to help patients when they're in that situation.
Well, one of the things that I always talk about is, first of all, that sickle cell is a very complicated disease. And many times you hear people describing it as it was described when it was first discovered, and that the cells are no longer around, they get sickled shape, and they cause blockages, and that's what's causing the pain. And I think when I hear you talk about it and the fact that you can see things on the computer, right, that are actually measuring responses from the patient, that part of the reason we can see these things now is because of the technology. So I'm the technology geek. So I'm happy that technology is able to verify what it is I've been saying for nearly 40 years, and that there are doctors like yourself who are using that technology in order to try to help our community suffer less. I know that the ER can be traumatic, even for a veteran mother like myself. When I hear you talk about this and the work you're doing, I mean, we're just so grateful that you've taken an interest in this, and you like technology too, so.
Well, I started out before I went to medical school. I was in the physics department at the University of Michigan, so I'm sort of a card-carrying geek.
Yeah.
And my collaborators are all engineers, except one. And Dr. Lonnie Zeltser is a good friend of mine. She's the head of the pain program at UCLA.
Yes.
And she does, she's really terrific, and she's helped us a lot. And she's part of this research. And her research interest has been for years what are called cognitive-based therapies. And that means things like meditation and yoga and stuff like that. And, I mean, we all know we're not going to cure sickle cell disease with meditation.
Right, right.
But I think that, you know, it takes a sort of takes a village. We need to put all these things together. And it's really one of the things that she and I are excited about is we now have a way to actually measure some of these things, because it's kind of hard to measure anxiety and fear, you know.
Right.
And but we can measure the responses to them, and I think that we can probably modulate some of these things. I mean, you know, I mentioned that narcotics actually make this secondary nerve pain worse. And by the way, you mentioned some words when you were talking earlier. You know, nerve pain has different characteristics. I mean, when the patients say that I have pain all over, and if you just touch me, it hurts, just lightly touch me, it hurts. I remember very well one of my patients saying that it was excruciatingly painful when the nurses were putting her socks on in the hospital.
Yes.
And everybody was giving her a bunch of attitude because they thought that she was nuts. And the people in the hospital here at Children's, where I think we hopefully know a little bit about this, they didn't know what allodynia is. Allodynia is the word for having a painful response to something that's not normally painful. That's a classical sign of this nerve pain. And so shooting pain, electrical pain, tingling, this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. This is the description that patients tell us when they're having this kind of nerve pain. And even though this kind of pain doesn't get better with narcotics, and sometimes the patients feel better because they just fall asleep because you blast them with a bunch of morphine and they fall asleep, but the pain doesn't go away. But distraction makes the pain go away. And I remember so well a patient of mine who's now in his probably he's 30 or so, he's being followed by Dr. Miller over at Cedars, telling me we are giving him very high doses of fentanyl, which is a very powerful, it's 10 times more powerful than morphine. And his pain wasn't going away, and he had pain in his arm, and his arm was swollen, and he was playing Nintendo. And people who know me, I've told this story many times. He's a very polite young man. He said, "Dr. Coates, I apologize to you for not looking at you when you are talking to me, but if I stop playing Nintendo, the pain in my arm will come back." And so we know that distraction is very, very powerful. We know also that it works against patients in the hospital. I mean, classically, the families will come to visit them during the day and the kids will be fine. And then at night when everybody leaves, their pain gets worse.
Right, right.
And so the hospital people say, "Oh, you must be faking because your pain was gone when your mom was there and your pain came back when she left." Well, the mom and the family were distracting the child. And this secondary kind of pain, they're disconnecting the sensor, you know, the brain, from the pain signals and focusing it on something else. And if you can do that, if you can distract the patient from the pain long enough, it's like turning the amplifier that I was talking about down. And over time, it makes this nerve pain better. Time meaning weeks and long periods of time, not short periods of time. So this is very complicated, and one of the things that Dr. Zeltser is very interested in is trying to use these so-called cognitive-based therapies to help the patients. She actually has been hypnotizing. She's an expert in hypnosis, and we've been hooking the patients up to all this fancy gadgets that we built, and then she hypnotizes them, and we're trying to understand how that might work and how we might be able to use things like that as an adjunct along with other things that we do to try to help patients control and cope with their pain. None of that's going to work in an emergency room.
Right, right. We actually went in and were participants in Dr. Zeltzer's study. And the really interesting thing that happened when we were there was I was the one who, after so many years of just saying, just breathe, you know, just you know, breathe with mom, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I was the one who had the, oh, yeah, they're going to turn this thing up kind of reaction, which I thought was pretty funny. Marissa yeah. thought it was not so, you know, she thought, oh, well, it's your turn, mom.
yeah.
But, yeah. I do know that when Marissa was young, we would experience this. I would be with her. She'd be okay. I would then say, all right, I'm going to go down to the cafeteria and get coffee or whatever it was I was going to get. And she'd say, all right. And I would leave. And then when I would come back, the nurses would be in her room. She would be in tears and saying, you know, how much it hurt. And I was thinking, I was gone 15 minutes, really? Kind of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally kind of got to the point where I understood more about the physiology and how as you've explained so well here, I mean, and I'm actually going to use that from now on when I'm explaining the different types of pain, really what was going on. And it's really hard as the caregiver to you're in that role, you're like split up. You are the mother or the dad or the person, and you really care and want to protect and not have your loved ones suffer. And that is the first and foremost, right? The part that you're leading with. But there's another part of you that's back trying to be the observer to see how you can prevent whatever is going on at that particular moment happening again. And you're also a person, right, who's had this collective life experience. I was listening to someone today talk about how the collective anxiety of being in a neighborhood where there's shootings, of being, for us as people of color, a collective experience of being discriminated against. I mean, you're having all that, and so when you're there interacting, you're trying to filter through all of that and still yourself to just be there in the moment and see what's going on. And there have been times when I've looked at my child and said, just stop it. You know what I'm saying? Because everybody's looking at me as if I'm now the enabler, as opposed to being the facilitator that I believe I'm being. But I would get that look, as you said, you know, the other people rolling their eyes, that kind of thing. I know that there's a lot of work going on now to try to help everybody communicate better. And the children going forward and the parents going forward now will have a lot more knowledge than I did, certainly, when I was starting out. So how many people have you had in your study? Let's talk about the study. Well, actually, first I have to take a break, and then we'll come back. All right, so we want to thank everyone. You're listening to Access Advocacy, and we are speaking with Dr. Thomas Coates from Children's Hospital here in L.A. We'll be right back on The Power of Voices. Welcome back. Today we are speaking with Dr. Thomas D. Coates of Children's Hospital in Los Angeles. So we're going to ask Dr. Coates some details about this study that he's been working on. So how long have you been working on it?
Well, I mean, I've been involved in sickle cell research since the early 90s, but I think
yes.
A long time, which is amazing because I'm only 25 years old.
Absolutely, and you don't look a day over 18.
Yeah. This current grant is a 5-year grant. We're in the fourth, about to start the fourth and final year. got to figure out how to get more money, because one of the things that's happened is we've had this big, terrific collaboration between all the people that have been involved in this, and we've made a lot of progress. I would just, you know, quickly say that the pain thing isn't the only thing that's going on. One of my other colleagues, Dr. Wood, who is an engineer and a cardiologist, is looking at cognitive function and brain function in kids with sickle cell, and another colleague, Dr. Koo, from the engineering school, who's helping us do all these calculations. And so we have a lot of people working on this, and it's been a real team effort. And actually, across the United States, I have to say there's 7 other centers, and everybody's been working together, and so a lot of very good data coming out. I have a very good colleague in Minnesota who works with sickle mice and has made a lot of advances with respect to our understanding of pain and sickle cell disease. She's actually doing acupuncture and massage in mice, if you
wow.
can imagine that.
I can imagine
but,
that.
but I think we've had 60 or so experimental episodes now with the pain study, and also we have a mental stress study that we've done in about equal number of patients. A lot of patients have worked in different aspects of this overall study. One of the things that's been really terrific is we've had several, we're now about to have our 4th pediatric hematology physician involved in this research. This was all started 5 years ago by Dr. Pulliel, who is now in Cleveland, and Dr. Khalil, who's about to start her pediatric training, and now Dr. Velaswamy, who's one of our hematology fellows, and we have a new fellow who's now interested. So we're training. Dr. Denton's going to be starting in July, so we're training physicians also, hopefully. And we have actually an anesthesiology resident, Dr. Gabido, who's from UCLA, who's also working with us. We're trying to train doctors to be, to understand these things too.
Well, you have no idea, how happy that makes me, because we have, as a community, certainly suffered through not having enough doctors trained. I mean, there seems to be, when we started this in the 90s or the 80s, we had quite a few pediatricians who knew about sickle cell. And it was as if we had pediatricians and people treating sickle cell, and we were sort of on the forefront of what was going on. But then once the AIDS epidemic hit, much attention and resources was turned towards that. And I often say how much I understand that. I mean, hematology was on the 4th floor at Cedars, where the peds wards was, which was where I was with Marissa. And, you move in basically when your kid is sick. They allow you to move in.
Yep.
And I would walk the halls and go over to the other side, and I witnessed firsthand that journey with many, many people from the beginning, where they would leave the trays outside the doors to the point where they actually established the AIDS ward, and just watching what happened and the fact that they really did stop it, the research stopped it, and those people are living. But now, or shall I say, once Marissa became an adult, I became aware of how scarce knowledgeable hematologists were that, dealt with sickle cell, and learned that there had been really a bit of an educational gap. And to hear you say this, I think, there's hope for the pipeline,
Well, I think one of the things that's important to understand, and I've been trying to work on this, we have a program, a transition program that actually was the brainchild of Dawn Canada, who's our amazing sickle social worker here. And Annie Nord, who is a nurse practitioner, she's going to become a nurse practitioner. She was my research nurse for 11 years. And now Jackie Baskin, who's a junior faculty member, to try to work on transition to adulthood. But one of the problems that people sort of need to understand is that we're talking about a rare genetic disease in California.
Right.
So there's about 7,000 patients, we calculate, in the state that have this out of 35 million. And so just statistically, the probability that any physician has ever seen a patient with sickle cell disease is very low. And so we have about 300-some patients here. There's a center in Oakland, Dr. Brzezinski's group in Oakland. There's a focus in Sacramento. That's sort of it. I mean, African-American population is only about 8% of the state of California.
Yeah.
.016%, 0.01% of the population has sickle cell.
Right.
And in medicine, you know, you can't really know how to manage something rare like this unless you've seen a lot of cases. So the idea that you can have somebody rotate through our clinic for a year and then go out and know what they're doing, this is just unrealistic.
Yeah,
it doesn't happen. And that's true of any medical disease. So we're trying to figure out how to deal with this. And one of the problems we have in pediatrics in general, here's some statistics, okay? There's 250,000 children born in the sub-Saharan Africa every year with sickle cell disease.
Right.
Okay. 80% are dead by their second birthday.
Yeah.
In 1975 in the United States, the median survival for sickle cell disease was 12 years. That means half the kids passed by their 12th birthday. With the implementation of treating infections and really our understanding mainly about infections in sickle cell, now 98% of kids with sickle cell disease are alive at age 18.
Right.
So this is true of all or many rare pediatric or genetic diseases. And so what this means is that there are no adult providers or very few adult providers that have expertise in any of these rare diseases. So the idea that you can manage 20 patients or you've seen 10 patients with sickle cell and you know what you're doing is ridiculous. There's a handful of adult providers in Los Angeles. We're trying, what Dr. Baskin and Dawn and Jackie are trying to do is establish co-management linkages with adult providers so we can help. We can provide our expertise. I saw a new 30-year-old yesterday, not with sickle cell, but with another very rare genetic disease. Our practice is all pretty much rare genetic blood diseases. You know, I'm perfectly comfortable managing the blood of somebody who's 70 years old, but the body has to be managed by an internal adult doctor, right?
Right.
And so this is a problem, and most hematologists actually don't know much about sickle cell disease, even in pediatrics. You know, the majority, we're different here at Children's because there's 40 hematologist oncologists here, basically. And we have a group of five or six of us that specialize in the non-cancer business, but most hematologists are cancer doctors.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true in the adult world. But we've identified a handful of adult providers who are interested and willing to help take care of the adults with sickle cell and with the other diseases. And we're trying to figure out a way to work together on this. Because in an adult practice, they can't really afford to take care of 300 sickle cell patients either. Just financially, they can't do it. And so there's a lot of issues. Money, I mentioned financial money is an issue.
Yes.
And expertise is an issue, and there are a lot of things. There's another research part of our program that's trying to address how to provide good care for adults with all kinds of rare diseases, but sickle cell is the most common of the rare diseases that we deal with, and it's still pretty rare. So this is problematic, yeah.
Well, so I'm going to stop here for just real quick and do my survey thing, because I've been thinking a lot about what you've said, you've mentioned just now about the economics of it. I know that when we first started Access Advocacy, we had sort of an idea where we would do patient education and, you know, that kind of thing. And then we sort of moved into, because we kept running into people who were having such difficulty in getting care or support while they were getting care. For example, I called them our orphans, so they would be mostly adults. Mm-hmm. They're actually all adults. And they were going to the ER alone, or they had been in the hospital for, you know, a couple of weeks without visitors or anyone to really sit with them and help communicate. And so we kind of shifted our priorities as we were able to spend a year with people and really analyze what the needs were and what we could do as advocates. And one of the things we, sort of the conclusions we came to was, A, this lack of adult doctors and the disparity between doctors who were taking care of sickle cell patients and what they were paid and what docs were being paid that were providing care for people with cancer. So in cancer, you not only had the sheer volume, meaning the number of patients that they treated, but there were differences in what their pay rate was, especially when it came to Medi-Cal and Medicare. So we're kind of looking at that and what can we do as advocates to get that righted. Our belief is that a specialist's time is a specialist's time, and there should be parity between cancer and treatment of sickle cell. The other thing is us having a rare disease, and how can we get experts like you helping someone who's not even that far away? Let's say they're in Antelope Valley, but that's a long trip for someone to have to try to make to get to see a doctor, or the hospital there doesn't have anybody. So what do you think about telemedicine for consultation?
Well, you know, this conversation could go on all day. I've got to tell you this. So, I've thought a lot about this.
Yeah.
And Dr. Baskin is, and Annie and Annie Nord and Dawn and Kelly. We have a whole team at Kelly Russell and Nathan. So we're trying to address this issue. And there's a colleague of mine that is working with us, Dr. Chip Manus, who's the head of health services researcher. He's a PhD psychologist at the University of Florida, Gainesville. And his whole shtick is research on trust. And Chip and I have been talking about, well, we think the key thing is how do we develop trust between the patient and their provider and the provider in the sickle cell center. One of the problems is, because we're not going to teach somebody in Antelope Valley who sees 20 sickle cell patients or one, you know.
Yeah.
First of all, let me make it clear. It's not, this issue is not a, physician's salary problem. You're right. If you're running an oncology practice, you bring in lots of money that can support your whole practice because you're giving these expensive drugs. And that's supported, and that's how you can run your clinic. And in sickle cell disease, the real issue is that there's nothing that supports the infrastructure that you need. You know, you can't support the social workers and all the different things that are going on to support them. It's not that, I mean, I can do this here because I'm part of a huge practice and because I have grants that pay salaries and stuff like that. And I don't want to get too far down this path. What I'm really hoping for is that the insurance companies are going to say, oh, wow, this represents a tenth of a percent, a hundredth of a percent of our people, but they have really difficult disease. We're going to fund this and let it be case managed by the two or three or four sickle cell centers that really know a lot about sickle cell disease. And let me just leave it there, because it's not going to be done in private practice. There are some guys, you know, like Dr. Grant and Dr. Nasir, who are trying to fund their, and Dr. Miller, who are funding their care of sickle cell patients off of their oncology practices.
Right.
But to do this, I mean, I'm really afraid that we're going to lose these guys. I mean, their hearts are all in the right place, and it's just really, really, really difficult. So I think this is a great conversation. It's a very long conversation, and I don't want to eat up all of our time on this. We need to really carefully think about what's the most effective way to find the individuals who are most knowledgeable and get them hooked up with doctors that can help. There's a last name is Chalk. I forget his first name. Anyway, he said to me when I was there at the sickle cell meetings a couple of years ago, you know, Dr. Coates, I don't care how much you know. I want to know how much you care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If I know I have a physician in the community who cares and wants to take care of the patients, I can provide the technical knowledge, and we can work together. And I think, in summary, that's sort of what our approach is. We're trying to find the docs out there who may not have a bunch of sickle patients, who may not know a lot, but are the doctors that are going to say, hey, wow, I don't know much. I just saw one of these sickle cell patients once when I was in residency, but I really would like to help. You know, if somebody that says, I know it all, you always got to be careful about any
exactly.
doctor that thinks he knows it all. All right, myself included, I do not believe that I know it all by any stretch of the imagination. But I think that this is really the, you know, the key is to find these individuals and then figure out what can we as a center, and as a center, I'm including you. We need input from the families. I need to have you get out there to the patients and tell them that there's another kind of pain that gets worse with narcotics, because we've got to solve this narcotic problem, you know, and that's education. But I think that that's really the crux of what we're trying to do. We find people who care and want to help, and how can we get the information to them so that we can work together? Because I can't see I would if I could, but I can't see every sickle patient in Southern California. So let me just stop there and turn it back to you.
Well, as I said before, when we started this journey, we were thinking one way, and now are kind of where you are, in that, you know, we're all getting older and we've lived through this and fought this and are still fighting it. And how do we sort of shore up the next generation? How do we take what we've learned and help others, or set up the infrastructure for those coming after us? I remember doing my very first speech was at a sickle cell conference in Boston, and this was many years ago. And I did a talk where I talked about the establishment of the virtual team. It's the same concept that we have in, I was taking it from software design and software development, in that you basically have this team of people that aren't necessarily in the same spot, but have the right skills, that trust each other. And you use those skills to develop this piece of software. So I was saying, why can't we have this model for taking care of a person with sickle cell disease?
I mean, I do this with thalassemia. I have managed patients all over the country slash world, actually, by email with doctors who I've never met. But thalassemia is much easier, because you don't have this acute, you know, if you misdiagnose, there's like sickle crisis, you know, you have an adult with what the ER thinks is pneumonia, but it's acute chest.
Right.
And they think it's heart failure, and they treat it like heart failure, which can be fatal for somebody that's having acute chest. And things happen quickly, and that's the big problem that I have, is I can see adults with sickle cell, but I can't admit them here at Children's.
Right.
And so I think in that setting, one of the things to figure out is, I mean, to get an internal medicine doctor in Antelope Valley to call me, a pediatrician, about a 40-year-old patient,
right.
We need to break down this concept. We need to get people out there who understand that we need to find the individuals, you know, that and there's adult sickle cell doctors here as well, but I'm sure that, you know, Ellsworth Grant could help with a, you know, 12-year-old by phone, just like I could help with a 40-year-old, and Ellsworth is an internal medicine doctor. So there is a place for that. But I've done some telemedicine work, and I think this whole issue that we've been working with Dr. Manus about is how to develop trust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
if the doctor, I'm going to use Antelope Valley, for example, if the doctor there knows me and trust me, then we can work together. But if he's never met me before, it's problematic. And one of the things that patients need to understand when we're talking about, because often we're talking about pain management here,
right,
is that, I mean, I am quite familiar with using narcotics. I understand them pretty well. I've done a lot of this because of my oncology training and because of my sickle cell stuff. If some patient I've never seen before comes to me, I don't know them from Adam, and I don't know their doctor from Adam, and that doctor tells me to give them 30 milligrams of morphine, which is a huge dose, I would really resist that because we're talking about very dangerous things. And so, and that may work great for that particular patient, and it may have been tried and true, and his local doctor may know this and have done this a zillion times. Mm-hmm. But to expect that somebody, that another center is going to do something like that, right, just because a doctor they've never met before says to, this is also unrealistic. So, again, it's a big problem how to develop trust between referral centers and patients and their local doctors. This is a big problem, and unfortunately, like everything, you know, people don't donate money to do this research. I mean, I was just talking to somebody today. I've been 30 years working on this. Every single thing that we've done here has been on NIH money. I've had $25,000 of philanthropic support until just a couple of years ago when we got some more money to do this, which we focused it on this outreach project that we're doing. You know, it's a big problem, and I think you, the community, and we, the center, need to spend more time together to try to solve this.
I so agree. I mean, that was the other thing that I've learned in the last, 15 months since this is, you know, been really my focus, you know, and how little we actually get, our community gets donated privately, and how dependent we are. We're grateful, but really how dependent we are on getting funding for research through organizations like the NIH and the CDC. And I've also become very aware of what proportions we get as a rare disease community, but a fairly large rare disease, as far as rare diseases go, compared to others. I know early on when my daughter was, you know, 4 years old, and I think from 4 to maybe 9, we were actually working with the cystic fibrosis group a lot and doing some fundraising stuff together. And then there was a split between CF and the sickle cell group. But their funding, even through NIH, is something like 3.5 times as much as we get. So that's one of the things we're looking at, is what can we as a community do? Part of it is the fact that our community has so little money. Right? As individuals, on TV, we see our basketball stars, our sports stars, we see our music, you know, stars. But again, we only make up, I think at this point, we're 12% maybe of the population, of overall population. We have a lot of money that we spend in stores. But getting money for things like support for our research and things that and our health care is going to be a challenge, which is one of the ones we're going to be focusing on. We have just a couple of minutes before I let you go, so I want to get your thoughts on this.
Well, I think part of it also is where the money is focused and the money that is out there. You know, I have some opinions about where we should, you know, focus research and what we should do and what I would do if I had a bunch of money. And I was on the Sickle Cell Advisory Committee at the National Institutes of Health for a while, and I remember one time at one of these meetings they were talking about this new drug that they were going to get out there. It was an amazing new medication. There's been a couple ones now for sickle cell disease that have been developed, but a lot of these new drugs cost like $50,000 or $100,000 a year.
Right.
And we have a drug which is very effective, hydroxyurea, and it's not being prescribed because doctors don't know how to do it. And I remember just sort of blurting out at this meeting, why are you focusing research on these esoteric treatments when we can't even get this cheap medicine out there that works. And so it's, again, this is a long, a long discussion, and education, I'm all for that. There's a lot of things that people use money for, I think, that are all good causes, but focusing on something that's going to make a difference in the health of patients has always been my frustration. People raise money and they do things that are nice, great for the patients, but aren't necessarily going to get the word out about hydroxyurea, for example, or aren't going to affect their overall outcome. And that's been a little frustrating, to me, in terms of, even our own research program. So I don't, have the answers, but there's a lot of progress that's been made. And the NIH, there's the NIH does fund sickle cell disease.
Yes.
The CDC doesn't. There's some people, but it's not the CDC's fault.
Right.
There are people at the CDC who have tried to go out and fundraise themselves to support sickle cell stuff at the CDC. There's some wonderful people there. So yeah, and there's also a big backstory, I think, behind why people from the African American community don't necessarily fund sickle cell. There's some very rich people that just don't want anything to do with it. And again, we don't have time. I know you're running short here to get into that. But there's a reasonable backstory to all that. Also, by the way, it's important to point out 5% of the patients in California with sickle cell are Hispanic.
Hispanic, that's right.
So let me stop there. It's a big problem. Money is always important.
Money is important. So I can't thank you enough for taking your time out to talk to us. We hope that you will come back and talk to us more about your study, and hopefully we'll have some sort of plan or funding or something so that we can maybe get started on this whole idea of what, in my head, I'm calling our virtual care team. We can get the knowledge of someone like you into the hands of a provider who is willing to look after our people. So once again, this is Dr. Thomas Coates from Children's Hospital in LA. We'll return in a minute with more Access Advocacy on the Power of Voices.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Well, we're all out of time today, but before we go, I wanted to let you know that you can learn more about our organization on our website, accessadvocacy.org, or on the Access Advocacy Facebook page. That's axisadvocacy.org. Join us again next Tuesday on thepowerofvoices.com at noon Pacific, or listen anytime on demand at accessadvocacy.org. You'll find all our programs there. I'm Adrienne Shapiro. Thank you for listening.